Good morning. My name is Bill Paget, and I represent plaintiff appellant Robert Ortloff in this case. We were essentially here for three points of error. Two of them are alleged points of error, and one of them the government's alleged point of error. First, under the notice pleading standard of Rule 8A, the district court erred in dismissing Ortloff's right of access to court's claim for failure to, quote, establish, end quote, actual injury. Second, and this is more the government's point of error, we believe the district court actually correctly concluded that it had subject matter jurisdiction under the Tort Claim Act because the exception set forth in Section 2680C does not apply. Third, and this is our point of error again, during the bench trial of the Tort Claim Act claim, the district court was clearly erroneous in entering a cursory oral directed verdict against Ortloff pursuant to Rule 50A. Instead of issuing specific findings of facts and conclusions of law as required by Rule 52A of the Rules of Civil Procedure. First, with regard to the access to court's claim. As this court held in the Alston case, an inmate states an access to court's claim when he alleges, quote, some quantum of detriment, end quote, resulting in some interruption and or delay to pending or contemplated litigation caused by prison officials. Now, the notice pleading standard is not somehow eviscerated for purposes of an access to court's claim. Here, the district court completely blurred the bright line of demarcation that must exist between, one, complaint allegations in the context of notice pleading versus, two, subsequent showings or specific facts supporting those allegations.
Let's talk about Christopher versus Harbury.
Yes, in Christopher versus Harbury, what happened there is the pleadings failed to even allege the cause of action that had been hindered or disabled due to the defendant's conduct. And we pointed this out in our briefing. In fact, all three of the cases that the government points to, each of the elements that were missing in the pleadings are present in this case. For example, Mr. Ortloff specifically named several pieces of pending litigation.
But where's the detail regarding those pending pieces of litigation?
When you say the detail...
Yes. Christopher requires enough detail for the claims to stand on their own.
The detail set forth in Mr. Ortloff's amended complaint were that discovery materials, thousands of pages of discovery materials, were either destroyed or completely missing due to the defendant's conduct, and due to his inability to review and recompile those discovery materials, it had adversely affected his ability to prosecute.
But surely there could have been some detail other than the citation, name and docket number, that can't satisfy Christopher, can it?
I think the turning point in the Christopher case was that, for the Supreme Court, was that it had failed to identify the specific piece of litigation. And the argument made by the plaintiff was that the destruction or loss of the materials had prevented the plaintiff from prosecuting some cause of action. And I believe the Supreme Court's problem in that case was with just the general nature of some cause of action. I think here we have to look at another Supreme Court case. As the Supreme Court noted in the Lewis case, quote, on a motion to dismiss, we presume that the general allegations embrace those specific facts that are necessary to support the claim, end quote. Now, the access to court claim in Lewis was only rejected at the three-month bench trial. Ortloff satisfied the notice pleading standard for his access to court claim when, in his amended complaint, he alleged that he was hindered and prevented from prosecuting the claims and specifically named lawsuits as a result of the mishandling of the legal material, and specifically alleged that his efforts in those cases had been prejudiced. And getting to your point...
Did he show the arguable nature of the underlying claim is more than hope? That's a quote out of Christopher.
In terms of in pleading context, I believe that part of his complaint set forth in the pleadings was that he was unable to determine the exact nature of these discovery materials and knew that, but his inability to have these discovery materials that prejudice his claims in these enumerated pending actions. Moving on to the Tort Claims Act, subject matter jurisdiction was present under the Tort Claims Act because the exception in 2680C is inapplicable for two independent reasons. First, BOP employees are not, quote, other law enforcement officers, end quote, for purposes of the exception set forth in Section 2680C. Statutory construction and legislative history support a narrow reading of this exception, limiting it to the tax and customs context. As we all know, statutory phrases are to be read as a whole, and general terms, such as other law enforcement officers, must be interpreted in light of the specific words preceding them and in the context of the specific language surrounding them. Here, within the statutory provision...
How about the Tenth Circuit decision on that?
The
Walkner case.
Its view of that statutory construction
issue? Yes, it says that prison guard charged with mishandling property also qualify as law enforcement officers.
I would argue that it can go either way, and so even the I believe the D.C. Circuit said that interpretation is plausible, but when read as a whole, I believe that it should be limited to the tax and customs context, and I don't think that Tenth Circuit
What case are you referring to? The Coffitt case?
Yes, the Coffitt case.
Well, that says it may include non-tax, non-customs agencies.
When they are acting within the context of
that's just
customs
an
and tax.
That doesn't limit it.
Right, correct. But what I'm saying is it could be a state trooper. It could be a Department of Corrections officer if they're acting within the context of customs or tax. They could be assisting a customs officer. That's what I think the proper interpretation is in light of this language, which not once but twice within this exception refers to the notions of tax, customs, or excise. The second independent reason is that Ortloff's legal papers and work products are not, quote, goods or merchandise, end quote, as described in the exception in 2680C. A plain and ordinary meaning of that phrase does not encompass legal papers, work product, for example, the manuscripts of the next great American novel, or patent drawings of the next great widget. These are the types of things that the government is trying to draw into the language of goods or merchandise. In April 2000, an amendment was added the phrase or other property. We believe that amendment confirms our argument that this should be, that you can't just blow up the language goods or merchandise into any tangible piece of property. Briefly, the district court finally committed clear error in addressing the Tort Claims Act by entering an oral directed verdict. The directed verdict under Rule 58 is only appropriate in a jury trial, and for a bench trial you need specific findings of fact and conclusions of law under Rule 52A. These specific findings and conclusions mandated by Rule 52A are not an issue of form over substance. Rather, they are the required form that ensures a full and complete substantive analysis of the evidence and application of the law to that evidence. And very briefly here, there was evidence that could have satisfied the res ipsa cause of action, and that was not at all discussed in the findings. And there was
you have half a minute left.
Yeah, I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Time.
Thank you.
All right.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Kathleen Kane for the United States. If I may, I'd like to begin with the 2680C issue. 2680C applies to this case because the phrase, or any other law enforcement officers, means what it says. Mr. Ortloff contends that in the process of detaining his personal property for law enforcement purposes, prison guards damaged or lost some of his papers. In other words, this claim arises out of the detention of goods by law enforcement officers and therefore comes within the exception.
Now, is this the position of the Attorney General now?
Yes, Your Honor.
They want that, what I would call a broad interpretation to the exception.
Yes, Your Honor, that any other law enforcement officer.
And that prison guards and a lot of other people who are on the outer perimeter of law enforcement would be included in this, I guess you'd call it, in this exception.
Well, Your Honor, of course, the very outer parameters of how this would apply, it's not clear. I mean, it has to apply to an actual law enforcement officer.
This is an administrative procedure that they're going through here. So collecting and doing whatever they're doing. Admittedly, they are, I guess, prison guards, but they're not exactly, this isn't some kind of a stop or a search or something else. This is sort of cleaning out the cell.
Well, Your Honor, it actually did begin as a more conventional search because of the tip from the informant that Mr. Ortloff was involved in a gambling ring. And they used, apparently, stamps as currency for the gambling ring. So that is why the search was initiated and why his cell was, why all the property in his cell was detained and why he was sent to the special housing unit, all related to that initial issue, which is, in fact, a crime within the prison context. And while it is true that there may be some people who occasionally engage in law enforcement type activities but wouldn't qualify as law enforcement officers, the prison guards in this case are charged with ensuring safety, enforcing laws, executing searches and seizures, including of non-inmate personnel on prison property. So they are, for practical purposes, law enforcement officers in every common meaning of the term.
So the United States disagrees with the Sixth Circuit's position in this?
Yes, we do, Your Honor.
And which is the only one that seems to have any kind of an analysis.
Right. We do agree with the Tenth Circuit, which just held on identical facts, or not precisely identical, but that prison guards are law enforcement officers and that legal papers are goods when they are treated as property, as part of the prisoner's property.
You certainly don't argue, do you, that correctional officers possess general enforcement authority against the public at large as other federal agents do?
No, Your Honor, but within the confines of the prison, for example, if a visitor who is not herself an inmate violates a law, the prison guards can enforce that law within the confines of the prison. They're charged with that. So their function within the prison is as law enforcement officers.
Let me ask you this. Mr. Ortloff contends that his situation arose prior to the amendment, and so the earlier version of the statute would apply. Which version of the statute applies?
We believe that the statute as written in 1999 applies. In Mr. Ortloff's original brief, I believe they just overlooked that there had been an amendment, and so we pointed out in our brief that it had
been changed. Yeah, I know. It came in the reply argument.
Yeah,
I know that.
But even under that 99 version, we think that it's very clear that law enforcement officer is supposed to have its ordinary meaning and would apply in this context.
So would it no difference then? It wouldn't make any difference?
It doesn't make any difference to our case. That 2000 amendment added a great deal of text below the initial portion of 2680C, which is what we're looking at here. It was intended to expand the issue of regarding forfeitures, civil forfeitures in other areas. So that's sort of how that amendment came in.
Ms. Kane, I know Judge Coffey asked you if this is the DOJ argument now. I'm going to ask you if this came from Washington or from your office.
My office is in Washington, and it was discussed there, and it went up through the appropriate chain of command for review.
Okay.
I would just like to point out that in this court, in 1500 cases, while not necessary to the outcome of that case, did apply 2680C to FDA inspectors, saying that that would apply to a seizure of canned goods, and that was entirely domestic. There was no customs or tax implication there. And other cases, other circuits have, of course, applied it to Border Patrol agents, USDA inspectors, and again in Hatton v. White, to and its follow-on in Walkner in the Tenth Circuit, to prison guards. I would also like to briefly apologize for the error in our brief that is pointed out in the reply brief that was an accident in the way that we were wording that, and we should have worded more carefully how Paul interacted here. The purpose in citing Paul was to say that this court and others have looked at 1,500 cases as standing for the proposition that 2680C applies outside of the customs and excise context, and that's all we were trying to do there.
Let me tell you what my problem is, and maybe you can help me with it. The argument that prison guards would be included is unconvincing to me. Because it's based solely on definitions of law enforcement in other statutes and in other sections of the FTCA.
Well, Your Honor, it's not based solely on that. We use those as illustrative of how prison guards are normally considered, but primarily we rely on the common sense meaning of the statute. And so when you're talking about a law enforcement officer as someone who enforces laws and execute searches and so on, the prison guards do that within the prison context. That is their function there, and that is indeed what was happening here, was a search of the prisoner's property for illegal materials involved in an illegal gambling ring, which is how this all started. So that's a clear law enforcement activity that they were engaged in.
Well, the FTCA talks about, it's supposed to be kind of a specific permission of who can be sued.
Right.
And it just it seems that on the one hand you can interpret the narrow interpretation of the exception as fulfilling that purpose by saying only these people, I guess, are protected. And I don't know which is philosophically correct when you're talking about how to, in the broad purpose of the FTCA. I have a problem with this, one way or the other. And that's why I think the question about whether this is the official opinion of the United States, this is where everybody's going, and I guess you're going to challenge and where the Supreme Court and others to get this nailed down, at least, I guess, the way, contrary to the way Judge Crabb interprets it.
That's right, Your Honor. This is the position of the United States. And it is true that in certain cases, such as, I believe it was Sterling, we didn't raise the issue before, but that doesn't mean that it is not the position of the United States now, or indeed that it wasn't then. It's just simply that it wasn't raised at that point. One way of looking at this is COSAC tells us to look at the purposes behind the exception. COSAC, of course, itself gives a broad interpretation to the first part of the language, the arising in respect of language, and finds that Congress meant to sweep broadly there in terms of carving out the exception. Similarly here, COSAC described the purposes of the exception primarily as to protect the free actions of law enforcement, in that case customs officials, but law enforcement generally, and to deter fraudulent or excessive claims. And only secondarily, in their words, did it look at, you know, the issue of what common law remedies were available. And those purposes apply with equal force here. Are we really going to read this to say that prison guards can't detain someone's goods and search them for illegal contraband and dangerous materials without incurring tort liability? It seems contrary to, whereas giving prisoners rights under the FTCA that regular importers wouldn't have against customs. It seems like a contrary and illogical interpretation of this exception to apply it in that way. I'm troubled. Thank you. My time is up.
Thank you.
One minute, sir.
Just very briefly, following up on the end of the government's argument. In terms of the Pandora's box suggested there, I think that the elaborate inventory procedures they're shown throughout the record suggest that the government and the BOP recognize a duty to be careful. So I think that has to be taken into account to mitigate that issue. And as far as positions coming from Washington or the United States, I think the positions here are very inconsistent with regard to the goods or merchandise and with regard to the other law enforcement officers, because just as Judge Easterbrook stated in the Paul case, this court should be troubled by the inconsistency of the government urging a functional reading of goods or merchandise while urging a literal and vastly broad interpretation of, quote, other law enforcement officers, end quote. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. We will take the case under advisement, procedure case number 3.